Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Hello, everybody, and I'm really looking forward to this show today. My guest today is Beth Kirlin. She is a clinical psychologist. She's a TEDx and public speaker. She's a mind and body coach. Yes, I'm going to keep going. She's an author, and she's an award-winning author of three books, and she's just released her latest book, and I can assure you it will be an award winner as well. And her latest book is called You Don't Have to Change Everything. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Me too. And, you know, and I appreciate you saying that, because I really do, as I say in my opening, I really do see these as conversations. I know I would say the majority of podcasters consider what they do interviews. I personally don't. I really do believe that if we were sitting at Starbucks, we would be having the same conversation. So I would like
that.
Our guests. Yeah, but it's true. I'd like our listeners just to know right up at the start how I spell your name and how they can find your wonderful website. So if you want to go to Beth's website, obviously there's three W's, and her name is Beth, BETHKURLAND.com. And then you will find Beth there, and you will be able to then look at her website. I don't know why when I copied it, it put an R under your name where it says B-E-R-T-H, but that is wrong. So let's just make sure we've got it right. It is Beth, B-E-T-H-K-U-R-L-A-N-D. Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
So let's start off, Beth. I've said a little bit about you, but I really like hearing from my guests. So please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I always kind of like where to start with that question.
Exactly.
But, yeah, a lot of different places. I guess, you know, when I think back, when I think about writing this newest book and where it came from, I really think back to when I was much younger. So back really in elementary school, I just fell in love with writing. And at that time, mostly poetry was really my form of self-expression, and kind of looking back now, I can almost label it as a kind of mindfulness meditation in motion for me. But it just really gave me this chance to reflect on life and on things that mattered to me. And also it allowed me a place to put some of my more difficult emotions that I was working through, and also, you know, the joys and some of the awe that I experienced in life. And it's so interesting, even looking back, like at a young age, or seeing, you know, kids can really, there's a depth there sometimes, you know, that you don't always appreciate. But so writing for me became an important therapeutic avenue, really. And I thought I wanted to be a writer for many years of my life. And then when I hit high school, a couple things happened. One is that I took a social psychology class that was one of these elective classes, and I just fell in love with psychology. And I decided that I wanted to be a psychologist, in part, I think, was influencing. I got to be a mentor for a younger person in middle school. And that experience, there was just something about that I just felt like I really am called to this. So there was a real, I guess, calling and passion there. And somehow woven into my story, which certainly is woven into the book, but my mom died when I was 15.
Ooh.
And So that was, and it was a very sudden kind of car accident. And so there was a lot of grief that I went through and my family went through at that time. And a lot of ways that I think I really didn't fully work through a lot of that grief and trauma until later on in my life at different points in my early 20s and even into, you know, when I gave birth to my children and became a mother for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of my own personal healing that I went through and working with some wonderful therapists along the way that gave me so many wonderful tools. And somewhere in there also, I think, especially in college, I really became drawn towards the mind-body practices and meditation and other sorts of mind-body practices that became really transformative for me in my life. So I started to integrate these into my practice with patients and into my books, and I guess I'll stop there. That's a long-winded
But what you've just said all makes sense to me, frankly. And is the East Coast, where do you call home?
Yeah, so East Coast is pretty much, well, I was born in Michigan and I spent a year in Wichita, Kansas, so when I was six years old. But for the most part, East Coast has been my home. Yeah.
Is that where you got your education?
I did, yep. In Massachusetts, went to Amherst College and then Clark University for my PhD.
Yeah,
oh, and then kind of moved, kept moving east. So I'm outside of the Boston area right now.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, it's always nice to sort of get a background. I always like hearing the backstory from my guests. It's relatable. I can't relate, frankly, to the horrific experience you had at the age of 15, but it's interesting, prior to that sadness, you were already in the journey of writing and poetry and mindfulness. It was your destiny. And I know you've been working with patients for over... Go ahead. You wanted to add something to that?
Oh, no. I was just going to say, yeah, I agree that I think it was my destiny in some way. That's
yes.
Just, yeah, kind of followed
that. I agree. So you've been working now with patients for over 30 years, and do you feel that I should be happier mentality has increased during this time? And if so, what do you attribute that to?
I think that I have seen some increase in that. And I also think, I should say, that there's a bit of a timeless message there from our culture as well, that you know, the just as human nature, I think, to some degree, to have that mentality. But I also think, you know, different pieces come into play here, certainly for me, and I speak from my experience in my particular culture and, you know, time growing up. But I think there's a lot of messages from the media, from advertising, from, you know, magazines, from pictures, and then of course, over time, when you ask the question, you know, has it increased? I think that social media has really, to some degree, really increased that messaging. I hear this from a lot of people that, you know, they're on their Facebook and, or whatever modality, you know, and just seeing people posting pictures of that. Everybody looks so picture perfect and happy and that kind of thing. And then they might come in and, you know, share with me, like, I feel like I'm falling short in some way, or what's wrong. I'm not feeling like that, or I don't look like those pictures. And I think behind those pictures, everybody has, you know, their own story and their own challenges. And we don't always see that. And so I think there is for sure this, you know, messaging that is out there that can sometimes pull people to feel like, gee, there's something wrong if I'm not feeling happy all the time.
I'm not as good as when you talk about the social media. I can see that. I am one of those people that is very much a part of social media because of what I do. So I want to be able to allow people in different avenues to know about my guests so that they can learn and appreciate something that somebody else is doing, and it allows us to do that. But it does come with its own restrictions and understanding. And I'm just wondering, since you've been doing this for such a long time, what are some of the difficult emotions that cause your clients to seek help to start with?
Yeah, I see, you know, quite a range of things. I mean, I would say the most common things that people tend to come in with are anxiety of some form,
mm-hmm.
you know, worry,
mm-hmm.
fear, and certainly depression of
mm-hmm.
various forms as well, grief, loss, sadness, sometimes more of the, anger, frustration, irritability, but just high stress.
Mm-hmm.
I think so many people are experiencing high stress right now in lots of different ways, personally and collectively. So I feel like I see quite a range of human emotions. And really, in that, you know, for me, it's very humbling. And I guess, you know, just sitting with so many people and just recognizing our shared common humanity, that in some ways we all feel these things to some degree, you know, and I think so many people who walk into my office might feel like I'm alone and feeling like this.
I'm the only one, right.
What's wrong with me? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it can be really helpful for people to know they're not the only ones, you know. And I think
right.
just to say a quick note with the social media, that I think there are certainly social media can be positive in that way too, that I think it can be a way for people to connect and to, you know, learn from others and you know, people sharing in,
mm-hmm.
in positive ways like that too about their experiences and that kind of thing.
I would agree. In fact, you know, as a widow, and it's been a long time, 15 years, but what happens oftentimes on social media is that groups form. And maybe it's a group of widowed men or widowed women, or something that I'm a hiker and where do you like to hike, or I'm a traveler and I like to travel. So there's I can see where there's the positives, but there is that protection of, you know, how much do you want a stranger to know about you? So I understand the ups and downs of the social media. But
yeah.
In your experience, how do people typically deal with an unpleasant emotion?
Well, I think that there's a couple things at play here. One
mm-hmm.
is that we are biologically wired to seek what's pleasant and to avoid what's unpleasant. And that was a really helpful and adaptive strategy for our Stone Age ancestors who had to, who had to avoid the saber-toothed tigers and, you know, getting bitten by the snakes and the poisonous plants that would make them sick. And so these external things, right, that they needed to avoid that were unpleasant, and seeking pleasant things in some way, you know, helped us to survive. But that biological adaptation in some ways plays out in our modern lives in terms of our inner emotional experience as well. So that there is some wiring by nature that when something unpleasant comes up inside of us, we tend to want to suppress it or push it away or get rid of it or ignore it. And I think it's also easy as human beings, and I speak to being on both sides of this for sure, to swing into the other extreme, which is that we can often then get kind of caught up in our emotions and
mm-hmm.
Even there's a term kind of emotionally hijacked by them, you know, taken over. And I think anybody can relate even just in the moment of anger, right? The, you know, you can kind of get overtaken by emotions as well. So I think that we tend to swing to either extreme there. And then I think there also are cultural and social messages. Again, at least I speak, you know, from my own experience of where I grew up. and some of the messaging around me and, you know, in the media and that kind of thing about, you know, what message, what emotions are acceptable to feel and what ones aren't acceptable to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what emotions maybe we then feel like because of this messaging, you know, we need to hide or not show other people, and what ones we might more openly share. But
right.
I think from my experience, most people have some of these early messages that they've learned about, you know, what emotions are acceptable and what ones aren't. So I think that's at play as well.
And do you think that, I think I know the answer to this. I'm really interested to know your response. Do you think men and women are wired differently that way?
I do think so, and I certainly think there can be, and again, depending on where in the world we're talking,
mm-hmm.
right? But there mm-hmm. can certainly be a cultural condition, a social conditioning as well.
Right.
You know, for example, that I do think, at least from my experience, again, where I grew up, that something like crying for boys is, you know, was not as acceptable.
Exactly.
For girls, that kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's really kind of amazing sometimes that even subtle messages that we can pick up from people around us, from our wherever environments, those can stick for a really
yes.
long time or even a lifetime sometimes.
Right. It's a condition.
Mm-hmm.
You've written four books now, but we're going to be speaking about your most recent book, which is You Don't Have to Change to Change Everything. And in that book, you talk about survival wiring versus thriving wiring. And I thought, that's really interesting to me. So let's identify the difference between the two. How would you identify the survival wiring?
Yeah, so a lot of this stems from polyvagal theory. I'll just name it. People don't need to understand that, but just to give a little bit of context for anybody who might be familiar with that term. But it's really understanding the evolution of our nervous system and how our nervous system evolved to help us survive as a species. And and so the earliest part of our nervous system to survive, to protect us was our shutdown response, our freeze response. And if you think about like a reptile playing, you know, an animal playing dead, kind of freezing
mm-hmm.
in the face of a predator, or even I think of, you know, kind of that turtle pulling into its shell, right? So there's this protective kind of response, but there's a shutdown of the nervous system in response to extreme danger. So that was the first part of our nervous system to evolve. And then the next part of our nervous system to evolve, again, through evolution, was this part of our nervous system that could now mobilize in the face of threat. Instead of just freezing, it could actually mobilize. So think about our Stone Age ancestors or whatnot, you know, having to fight or flee a predator, an animal, saber-toothed tiger, that kind of thing, in order to, and so the people who survived who had that response biologically, which is really part of our classic stress response, right, that our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, stress chemicals get released into the body. It gives us resources to mobilize. And so this was really adaptive to either fight a predator if you had to or to run away. And so mm-hmm. we have these survival responses that are all about protection. And they're still part of our biology, even though we typically don't face, at least, you know, for many of us, we don't face these kinds of external physical threats.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, when we're facing more of the kinds of maybe modern day challenges in our life, whether it be even just, you know, stuck in traffic, late for an appointment, or too much to do and not enough time, or trying to get the kids out of the house in the morning, or financial stress, or feelings of, you know, low self-worth, or an argument with a coworker or a family member, whatever, right? I could go on. But these mm-hmm. kinds of things can trigger our survival wiring because they're perceived by the nervous system as threat. And so our nervous system does what it knows how to do best, which is to try to protect us in the face of that threat. What can happen is that when we get, and this is all adaptive and it's not bad, you know, bad or good, we all experience some variation of our stress response, of this threat response as we go through our day, as we go through our week, and that's normal. But sometimes we can get stuck in that response, that we can get stuck in this protective circuitry to the point where we might just feel chronically stressed out. Or we might be stuck in states of anxiety or worry or anger or that kind of thing, and maybe that it's hard to move on or to shift as quickly as might be helpful to do so. And when we're in our survival circuitry, we don't have some of the resources that might actually help us best meet our modern-day challenges, if
Got
that
it.
Makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.
So it does. And I think everybody can relate to what you've just said. And sometimes mobilizing is not always easy. But then you look at the alternatives. So what do you recommend we strive for? Do you have sort of a, this is what I would say to my clients, if I was to come to you and ask you, well, what do you think I should strive for? What would you say to me?
Yeah, so I think that understanding that the nervous system has these adaptive responses and they're not bad, and that sometimes we need to protect ourselves in these ways, so that's important to say. And also understanding that we have this thriving wiring, if I like to call it or think of it, that when our nervous system perceives enough cues of safety, and I use that in the way of, you know, kind of loosely, but just being able to access some more inner balance, and I can talk about more about that, but when we have that balance, or we're able to find or bring that balance into our nervous system, and when our ancestors, you know, were not being chased by a tiger, they were free and went ahead, right, to figure out how to invent and to collaborate and to be creative and to problem solve and to, you know, be innovative in these different ways. So we have this other part of our nervous system that when we're able to access it, it kind of opens up. I think of it like a treasure chest that, you know, I imagine the lid flipping open. And, you know, there's all of these inner resources in this treasure chest that are waiting for us to be able to access, you know, perspective and compassion and self-compassion and courage and kindness and care and creativity and confidence and all of these things that when our nervous system is more balanced, we have access to that. So when you ask for what do we strive for, I think it's learning how to bring more regulation into our nervous system to understand what it needs at any given point in time. Deb Dana, who is somebody who's really brought a lot of this polyvagal theory into clinical work with patients anyway, I really respect her work. But she talks about, you know, that well-being is really a state of the nervous system being in regulation. And so that's something that we can learn, which is really exciting. And that's where some of these mind-body practices and mindfulness and things like that have been so powerful for me and in working with my patients and my clients.
I just yoga breathing. Just that simple, you know, I share with people, I said, these shoulders are not supposed to be earrings. They're really, you're really,
I love that.
But it's, But you can, it's a great analogy, because if you're really anxious, you know, the shoulders get higher and higher and higher, and it's like, wait a minute, they're not earrings. Take a deep breath. Let's get those shoulders back down where they belong. That's funny.
I can relate to that for sure. Yes.
Really, I can too. So I love that you say that it's not about trying to change yourself. It's about meeting yourself where you are. And how does somebody go about doing that? How do you help somebody do that?
So different ways I might respond to that. One of the things that can be really helpful is, first of all, just knowing that it's okay to feel what we're feeling,
mm-hmm.
and being able to differentiate our feelings from our behaviors. That all our feelings are acceptable, and our behaviors, we can choose how we want to act, what choices we make in a given situation. But just, mm-hmm. I think meeting ourselves where we are starts with that of just, it's okay to acknowledge that I'm having a difficult day, or I'm having a difficult mm-hmm. moment right now, or I'm feeling mm-hmm. really irritable, or I'm feeling intense sadness or grief right now, or whatever it is. So being able to start with where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that too, then, I think, is helping people to bring awareness into this moment, because another part of our biological wiring is that we're often on autopilot a lot of the time.
Yes.
And so I think about mindful awareness, which I talk and teach a lot about, almost like a flashlight. And if you imagine that you're in a dark room, pitch black, and you're trying to get from point A to point B, and there's furniture in the room, you might be tripping over things, you might be stumbling. But if somebody hands you a flashlight, then that room becomes illuminated, and the obstacles don't necessarily disappear, but you can navigate with more ease. And so when we can turn on that flashlight of awareness and begin to see what's happening inside, what sensations am I experiencing, what emotions are present, then we can meet them right where they are. We can meet ourselves right where we are. And in doing that, there's such an important message, too, of saying to ourselves, like, I see you. I hear you. I'm with you. And from there, I think all manner of change becomes a lot more possible just from that starting point.
I love the analogy of the flashlight, because sometimes, depending upon your life circumstances and where you are in your life, sometimes it can feel pretty dark. And your analogy is perfect. You really are going to chip over that table if you can't see it and you're in a dark space and you're trying to find the door. But with that flashlight, it's your partner. And you can, I'm a visual person, and you've just drawn something that's visual for me in that flashlight, because I'm going through a few things right now that I'd rather not be going through, and I'm thinking, wow, that flashlight's a really good idea. I like that. But one of the things that's really in your book is the vantage points, and there are six of them, and I thought we could spend some time talking about the six vantage points. And I think even before you tell me what the six are, I'm a definition person. So before you tell me what the six vantage points are, can you define I know you can. Would you define the word vantage?
Yeah, so I think about it like we're standing and looking from. Right. So if you
your vantage
imagine,
point, I see it now. Yes.
Yeah. Where are you looking from? And so, I'm also very visual, so I kind of mm-hmm. picture, right? Imagine a torrential storm, and you're just mm-hmm. kind of outside standing in the midst of the storm and the wind's whipping up and, you know, you're getting blown about. So if you then locate yourself, you know, that there's a shelter nearby, a little awning, mm-hmm. something where you can, you know, kind of safely stand under and it gives you a little bit of protection, right? Now you can't necessarily stop that storm, but you are looking at it from a different vantage point, and things
yes.
appear different when we move where we're standing, right? Where we move,
I love
from,
that.
You know, mm-hmm. our viewing point. Yeah.
As soon as you said that, I heard vantage different in my mind. So let's talk about those six vantage points. Let's start with number one.
Okay. Yeah, so the first one is what I call the anchor view. And this one I think of as, you know, they're not, I mean, in some way, they, in my mind, they are to some degree sequential. But they don't have to be. But I do feel like the anchor is kind of our first and most fundamental move, if you will, when we come up against difficult emotions, which we all do in our, you know, daily lives and weekly lives and so forth. So this inner turbulence and the vantage points, by the way, are all how do we meet and greet our own inner experiences? And where where are we looking from? Are we swallowed up in the emotion? Are we, you know, just ignoring it and kind of pushing it away? Or are we able to sort of watch it and be with it from some place where we can be present to what's there and be able to take effective action or, you know, that kind of thing. So, so the anchor view, and again, I guess let me go back to a little visual here, but thinking about that
yes.
storm, imagine you're swimming out in the ocean and a big storm whips up and you could try to fight that storm, you know, in which case you might exhaust your resources and kind of fighting these huge waves and so forth. You might, you know, if you let that storm sweep you away, that's probably not going to be so great. But if you imagine that there's a boat very close to you that's anchored, and you could make your way and kind of grab a hold of the rope that is attached to the anchor that anchors, you know, deep mm-hmm. in the ocean floor. From that vantage point, there's a little bit of safety and stability. And even though you may not be able to stop that storm from happening, there's a bit more ease in watching that storm pass by.
Mm-hmm.
And so the anchor is really all about going back to our survival wiring and our thriving wiring. How do we bring some balance into our autonomic nervous system so that we can begin to access our thriving wiring so that we can shift which system we kind of also think about as our old operating system and our newer operating system so that we can begin to have more access to our newer operating system. And often we need to bring some cues of safety into mm-hmm. our body in order to be able to deal with this turbulence, whether it's, you know, a big wave of anxiety or, you know, anger or whatever it might be. So there's lots of different ways that we can essentially anchor ourselves. You mentioned, and then this is such an ancient, I think part of, you know, this ancient wisdom of the breath as one way
right.
that can really help to calm the nervous system. And it's not just a folktale, you know, but there's a lot of science behind
mm-hmm.
it and understanding breath practices and ways that in particular, for example, if we slow down our exhalation and make it longer than our inhalation, that can really help calm a stressed out or revved up nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one way, but there's so many ways. And you know, for some people, focusing on the breath is not always helpful or can even be triggering. So being able to use imagery can be very powerful to help anchor or calm our nervous system. Engaging in the five senses, being able to notice what we're seeing or what we can touch or what we can hear, you know, sounds around us, things like that can bring us back into the present moment when we might be, you know, spiraling with anxiety, running into the future about something. And so there's lots of different ways that we can really learn how to grab this anchor. And from that place, once we grab an anchor and we look back out at that same situation, things can look and feel a little bit different.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
Yeah. I'll even have people experiment sometimes with just changing their body posture and their breath and their muscle tension. So these are all cues that get sent from the body up to the brain. And so if you think about a stressful situation and you hunch over, collapse your posture, and you tense all your muscles, and then you're going to notice it's probably hard to breathe when you're in that position. And you say to yourself, you know, I'm so stressed. And you think about that thing that's stressing you out. And just notice, like, how that feels in your body, what that looks like, what the vantage point looks like from that position. You know,
right.
And then after a moment, you let that go. And I love what you said about the shoulders, right? Take your shoulders and roll them up and back and let them drop back in their sockets. And just invite all the muscles to soften and begin to slow down the exhalation. And from that place where the body becomes more relaxed, you might say to yourself, you know, I'm so stressed. And think about the situation again. Does it feel the same or different?
Right.
What, you know, looking out from that situation, has anything shifted? Is there a little more space that's opened up? To maybe say, okay, I can kind of handle. Or think about, maybe I see a possibility I didn't see the first time around.
Can we go to a second? Because I know we've only got an hour, and we haven't
talked about
the other.
That's
fine. So what's the
sure.
second vantage point?
Yeah, the second vantage point is what I call the child's view. And if you watch, you know, young children and even, you know, fairly young infants, babies, that kind of thing, there's this innate capacity that we have as human beings to be curious and to turn towards and to explore things. And so, you know, if you give a small child a crumpled piece of paper, they could become really fascinated with that, right? And just like pick it up and want to look at it and kind of bring it towards them and that kind of thing.
Right.
And so this child view is all about cultivating this kind of curiosity that we can begin to bring to our inner experiences. Because like I said, our innate tendency is to push away or to maybe want to avoid or suppress what's uncomfortable. And if we can bring, this is an essential quality of mindful awareness, is this kind of curiosity to turn towards what's there. And so, you know, can I become curious when I'm driving, you know, and I've done this many times, of recognizing, oh, my God, you know, I'm gripping the steering wheel as if, you know, there's a dinosaur behind me or something. and, you know, if I can just be curious even about what's happening, you know, with these physical sensations in my body, then it opens up a space to maybe bring more ease. Or I can be curious, you know, if I start getting into an argument with my husband or something, right, which happens from time to time, right? You know, and I'd be curious, like, what's happening inside? You know, what's really getting triggered here? Is there something underneath the surface that I can, you know, okay, underneath my anger, there's really maybe some sadness that's getting tapped into, or I'm not, you know, whatever, it's bringing up something old for me. But if I can begin to pay attention and turn towards things with this kind of curiosity, it opens a lot more doors and choice about, okay, what's my next move? Where do I go from here?
That makes sense.
So it's something that, I think it's something that we often need to learn or practice. It doesn't necessarily come so easily.
Naturally.
When it comes to,
What's the third one?
So the third vantage point is what I call the audience view. So this is really building upon this mindfulness. Once we have this curiosity to begin to notice, you know, what's here, we can kind of learn to take that half step back so that we're not so swallowed up by what's going on. And it, so I think about, again, visually, if you imagine a theater at a performance on stage. And, you know, if you located yourself on stage, you'd be right in the middle of the drama. But now imagine that you're sitting in the audience instead, and you're watching the play unfold. Well, that's a very different vantage point. There's a little
Absolutely.
Bit of space between you and what's happening. And from this audience view, if we can begin to notice the things that are happening as they unfold with a little bit of that half step back, it creates that little space and distance so that, again, there becomes more awareness and choice about what's needed in this moment. Can I listen? Can I pay attention? Can I notice what's unfolding without being, you know, swept up in it? And again, this gives us a little bit of that access to that that treasure chest as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So some of those inner resources that become available from this audience view place.
And what's number four?
Four is the compassionate parent view. And this one is so powerful. And it's something that I think many of us aren't taught, I guess. And it really is one that is so helpful to practice, and really I think a life practice. But so it's this idea, if you think about, I like to use this analogy of a parent and a child, and imagine that that child is experiencing some distress, they're sad, something they really wanted to do got canceled or that kind of thing. And the parent could respond in one of three ways. The parent could ignore that child entirely and just let them to kind of, you know, be immersed in their own distress. The second response of the parent might be that they tell the child to snap out of it. Hey, you know, cut it out. Wipe the tears away and, you know, see that smile or that kind of thing, right? To snap out of it. The third response of the parent might be to put their arm around that child and say, you know, I'm so sorry that this happened.
Right.
And I'm here with you, and let's get through this together. Right? And so I think most of us would agree we probably would prefer that third kind of response.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when it comes to our own inner distress, I think most of us might treat ourselves more like that first or second parent, that we might tell ourselves, like, either to snap out of it, or we just ignore,
right.
or we feel like, what's wrong with
it.
Me that I'm feeling this way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And we don't often really kind of lean in, almost like that good friend for ourselves, to be able to really say, hey, I see, you know, what's happening here, and I'm acknowledging this, and I can hold a space for this. And just be present with, you know, right, even talking. I think it can actually be really helpful to talk to oneself in the third and second person, you know. But, hey, I see Beth struggling in this moment. She's really having a hard time. And then, like, what would I say to a good friend? You know, hey, Beth, this is a moment of difficulty, and it's okay that you're feeling this way. And, you know, let's see what, you know, what might help bring some more ease here. So it's learning how to be compassionate with ourselves in these moments of our own inner distress and turbulence that can really be game-changing, I think, in terms of helping us move forward.
Sometimes I actually do this. Sometimes I actually just stand in front of the mirror and have that conversation with myself. Because I know how I would treat my friend. I know how I would be compassionate with my friend. You need to apply that same compassion to yourself sometimes. And just thinking it isn't nearly as powerful as hearing it. Writing it is hearing it for me. That's just something that I find
that.
Myself doing. So what would be number five?
So five is what I call the mirror view.
That's so funny that I said mirror.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And this one is all about kind of what mirror we're looking in. So typically we look in the kind of mirror that we tend to look in is the one that reflects back the things we don't like, you know, and some of that can be, you know, more concretely, maybe oh, I don't like this or that about my physical appearance, but also this metaphorical mirror that reflects back the things we did wrong, the mistakes we make, the, you know, the things we think are wrong with us. Right, so we have this negativity bias of our brain, again, another evolutionary challenge of ours, that we tend to see and hold on to the negatives more than we do the positives. Mm-hmm. And so we can often go through our day and our week and sometimes our life from this, I call it the whole self view, H-O-L-E, you know, seeing the whole, seeing what's missing, what's wrong,
mm-hmm.
What's wrong with me, why did I do that wrong, you know, thinking, you know, we're broken and we need to be fixed, like any of that. And so this other mirror, the mirror view that I'm talking about, is really about cultivating this ability to look in a mirror that reflects back our strengths, the things that we're doing well, the things that were working for well for us that maybe we're not even noticing because, you know, there might be 10 things that we did well in a given day or that served us or that we might feel, you know, good about, but that one negative thing is overtaking.
Right.
And this metaphorical mirror can reflect back our inner qualities that are already here that, again, may kind of fall below the surface of our awareness or just not come into the limelight of our day. But yet when we can really begin to notice, it can be really transformative in helping us move forward. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like that. And the final sixth vantage, where does that stand?
Yeah, the sixth vantage point is what I call the ocean view. And I think that often we feel like we are an isolated wave. And we forget that wave is actually part of this vast interconnected ocean of which we are all a part. And so there's lots of ways of thinking about the ocean view, and I kind of touch upon a few different layers in the book, you know, at its simplest level, but I think also which can be profound, is how do we recognize this connection and interconnection around us? And find ways of really feeling and experience that in our life through different ways of, you know, finding meaning and purpose in things that may be, you know, beyond just our small self and that bring us into connection with our community, with other people around us in different ways. And so that we begin to recognize that we're not alone. There's a quote by William James that I remember when I was a teenager hearing this. It's something like the greatest use of a life is to spend it on something that will outlast it. And so this idea of how we can, you know, really think about ways of contributing and giving back and that bring us into connection with others in different ways. And actually, you know, you were sharing with me a little bit about your story before we hopped on. And so your show, right, is such a beautiful way for that. I think you have, you know, it's like such a gift to people at bringing, you know, such connection and interconnection to all your listeners.
Thank you.
So, and then, you know, there's other layers of the ocean view as well that, you know, I won't have time to get into, but just that are really interesting explorations of consciousness and what does it mean to be aware and conscious and a lot of really interesting research that's actually kind of Dan Siegel is somebody that I follow and anyway, a lot that could be said there. But
I like that. I like that one a lot. Yeah. I sometimes people just sort of float through life. We all know people like that. And maybe they're really not floating through life, but that's what we observe. And maybe actually they are much deeper and we don't know it. Maybe they do have an anchor view. But I like this ocean view idea. I think that that's really, to be honest with you, I can almost relate to all of these, and maybe that's best reality for anyone that's been mm-hmm. listening. I'm wondering, for you personally, do you have a favorite vantage point or one that you find the most powerful?
I would say, I mean, they're all, you know, kind of favorite children in different ways.
Right? Sure.
But I would say if I had to pick, I guess for myself personally, I almost feel like I have two favorites here, but I'll say two. So I would say, yeah, the ones that I have found to be really most profoundly transformative for myself and for the patients with whom I've worked are the compassionate parent view. So when people can, you know, and myself included, like I talked about my own grief that I went through. And so when I was mm-hmm. able to learn how to just meet and greet these inner parts of myself, really, right, these inner parts that held all these different emotions, not just grief, but that was certainly one. And to be able to hold that from sort of a more spacious, compassionate place with, you know, within myself, that became really transformative in my healing journey. And I've seen mm-hmm. that for so many patients in terms of just being able to name what they're feeling and to sit with it from a more spacious, compassionate kind of whole self and to be present with that, with the, mm-hmm. you know, more struggling parts that you know, we all experience.
Sure.
So that feels like it's just been so deeply transformative. And I think my other favorite is the mirror view. I was really fortunate in right after graduate school to spend a year of training at McLean Hospital, which is in Boston, but I worked with somebody, Dr. Robert Brooks, who I talk often about, and I talk about him in the book, and he taught me, and he was working with some very difficult children with all kinds of behavior problems and things like that, and what he found is that change comes about not by trying to find what's wrong and fixing it, but by finding what's right and strengthening it.
Mm.
And so it's this whole strength-based model that really that mirror view grew out of for me. And this idea that, you know, I think about as a therapist, what I feel like I do a lot in my work is holding up a mirror for other people and reflecting back in their strengths, the things they're already doing well and their resilience. You know, people even who have gone through trauma and maybe they're, you know, telling me their story, and I try to help them see, like, just, you know, how resilient they've already been just even in that part of the journey. And so I think when we can find ways to do that for ourselves, it is so mm-hmm. powerful. And when we can learn to do that with other people in our life too, I mean, imagine holding up that kind of a mirror for our kids or our partners or our coworkers or employees. You know, how different the world might be if we could really point out people's strengths and work from that place.
I think that is
so powerful.
I would agree. I would agree. And by the way, I do want to really direct people to your website. I'm looking at some recent posts, and just the title of this blog was Forget Your Bucket List, Try Buckets of Well-Being Instead, How to Get a Daily Dose of Well-Being One Drop at a Time. Many of us have bucket lists, but there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm a bucket list person, you know, and we, you know, and some things I write down, some things I think about. But I do think that there's a lot to be said for your page. I think there's a lot to be said for what you do and the different books that you've written. And people can really learn a lot from just going to your website alone. And I'm just wondering, with everything that you've done, you've written these books, you have a practice, And I always think that's funny, the word practice, like you're working to practice at this. It's an interesting term. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, what's next for you? Do you have, I started to ask you if you had a bucket list, but do you have something on the horizon that you would like to do next?
Actually, I do, and it's interesting because I was just starting to dive in a little bit more today on it. What I really love to do is working with people and helping them bring some of these practical tools into their lives. And so I am developing, kind of growing. I already had done one iteration of this from my previous book, but this newest book, and developing it into an online course where I can work with people online over the course. So I didn't kind of decide how many weeks yet it's going to be, but you know, we're each week we'll kind of go through and work with the material and really help people have experiences so that they can experience shifting their vantage point, and then, you know, taking them through over the course of weeks together of this journey to really incorporate this into their lives in a way that I hope to be very practical for people.
That makes a lot of sense. You're a teacher. I can feel it, and you're authentic, and I can feel that, because frankly, if you weren't either, this wouldn't make any sense, you know. But because this is, I'm just looking at the titles of your three award-winning books prior to this one you just wrote, and I'm just going to read it to people. One is called Dancing on the Tightrope, The Transformative Power of 10 Minutes, imagine, an 8-week guide to reducing stress and cultivating well-being, and the last one, which the title just cracks me up, Gifts of the Rain Puddle. I mean, that makes my face smile, Gifts of the Rain Puddle.
And that one was actually a collection of poetry. That was a little bit of a different kind of book, but that was fun. That was a collection of poetry and questions for reflection and things like that, yeah.
It's a full circle, Beth.
Yeah,
it's a full circle from what you just said.
Yeah.
When you were loving poetry and you were loving writing. And how, who knew, you know, first of all, you never would have expected the tragedy the way you lost your mother. I mean, but who would know that what started out as a young child's interest would continue to serve you so well today? I think there's a lot to be said for that. And I think that when people write books, you know, everybody needs to win. One of the persons that needs to win is the author. It has to make sense to you. And by making sense to you in your authentic way of explaining things, it makes sense to others. In fact, what blows into my mind right now is these would be fabulous audio books where people could actually listen to what your book is saying. Because
have the privilege of this last and my newest book, I was able to make into an audiobook, which was really fun.
Oh, that's terrific. I wasn't aware of that. How cool is that? I mean, I just think that, you know, the sky's the limit when it comes to you. And it's hard to know what's going to be next for you, but whatever it's going to be, not only are you going to benefit by that, because you need to, it needs to start with you, but then so does everyone that comes in your path, you know, and they learn from what it is you've taught them. And I just want to thank you so much for sharing that, for sending me your book, for letting me explore this with you, and to let people understand that you don't have to give up. The what-ifs don't have to take over. I'm an example of somebody that has that happen. And I, what if? Well, there's that anxiety. Well, let's see if we can step back from the what ifs. And I want to thank you for taking the time to explain this and to share your journey to well-being. And I just wish you all the best, because you are really somebody that's special. And I just want to thank you so much for joining me today.
I so appreciate that. It's so kind. Thank you. And I truly, you know, a graduate professor once said to me that we teach people what we most need to learn ourselves. And so what you were saying, you know, it just really resonates for me, because this is, you know, I tend to be on the, you know, wired stressed and anxious and all that. So, like, mm-hmm. my own, like, personal journey, it's like, yeah, I feel these things. And I try to teach people what I need to learn myself as well. And so
that's beautiful. It's beautiful. You know, and here we are across the country from one another, and I feel such a connection to you. And I look forward to hearing what you do next. And once again, thank you so very much for joining me. This is the last Monday in June, and I'm not quite sure what July is bringing for me. But we will see. If there's a little bit of confusion in this coming month, I'm not quite sure about my guests, but let me say something positive as we say goodbye. And that is, my son is turning 50 years old in July. My husband's mm-hmm. birthday would have been yesterday. His birthday was June 23rd. My son's birthday is July 23rd. And catch this. My son-in-law's birthday is October 23rd. 23 is a big number in my life. So, but I live a life of gratefulness, and I think that was one of your messages as well, is understanding your purpose and being grateful for your life. And so I'm just grateful for this opportunity, Beth, and I suspect that down the road you and I will visit again.
I would love that, and thank you so, so much for having me.
My pleasure. All right, everybody. Have a great rest of your day. I'm going to let Beth get back to what she's doing in Boston. Bye for now, everybody.
Visit MODO.US for the best free play social casino experience wherever you are. Modo offers a huge selection of Vegas-style games with free spins, exciting promotions, and always generous jackpots. You can waste your time with the others, or you can win at Modo. Register today at MODO.US for your free welcome bonus.
Modo is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
MODO.US.
Are you holding your breath while you request your ride? Or are you holding your breath once you're inside? I'm Will Coleman, CEO of Alto. Stop playing rideshare roulette. Download the Alto app to experience professionally trained employee drivers and company-owned luxury SUVs with our own pleasant signature scent. Try your first ride free with code TRYALTO. Download the Alto app or visit RideAlto.com/radio to learn more.